Skyde med regn flere steder. I løbet af dagen klarer det op med lidt eller nogen sol og kun enkelte byger hister her. Temperaturer mellem 15 og 18 grader. Og vinden tiltager og bliver let til frisk ved kysterne, stedvis op til hård vind omkring nordvest.
Du lytter til Radio 24/7. Danmarks nyheds- og debatradio. Hør os live eller on demand på radio247.dk. Velkommen til Aflyttet med Anders Kjær Ulf.
Velkommen til et program, der er iført skæg og blå briller, i hvert fald indeni, hvor et ruende gennemregistreret mørke hersker, men også et mørke, hvor striber af lys trænger ind, ikke kun fra blitzlys, men også noget, der ligner regulær håb for fremtiden. I sidste uge, der kunne vi fortælle om datafællesskabet, der går efter at lave et dansk uovervåget internet, og i dag, der kommer lyset fra en fagforening, den hedder PROSA, Forbundet af IT-professionelle. Jeg er formand Niels Bertelsen her i studiet, og Niels, I har fået nok af overvågning af borgerne, I vil give os digitale rettigheder. Som det hedder. Hvad er det, I vil gøre for, at vi får det?
Jamen, vi har været trætte af det gennem mange år. Vi har jo advaret stort set, siden man introducerede de første antiterrorpakker, om at det var den forkerte vej at gå i forhold til at lave den her masseovervågning af borgere, som ikke havde nogen effekter, så samtidig bare tilsidesatte de rettigheder, man ellers har i et normalt samfund. Så det har vi været trætte af i rigtig lang tid. Men det, vi kan se nu, det er, at der er sket ligesom en opbrydning. Der er ligesom kommet et større fokus på det, både med Snowdens afsløringer og med EU-domstolens afgørelse omkring logningsdirektivet, altså hvor de har underkendt logningsdirektivet, har vist, at der er lidt grøde i det nu, og måske også en større opmærksomhed på det. Og derfor sagde vi til os selv, jamen så lad os da prøve nu og se, om vi kan samle nogen til at få egentlig formet nogle digitale rettigheder, så det bliver mere præcis, hvad det er, der skal ske i sådan et digitaliseret samfund.
Hvad betragter I som, skal man sige, de ting, I er op imod? Nu nævnte du selv lige før logningsbekendtgørelsen. Er det noget, I vil gøre noget for at få ændret?
Jamen, vi kan jo se, at der er jo større bevågenhed for politikerne for at kunne lave de her ordninger, hvor man overvåger, fordi det på en eller anden måde skal vise en handlekraft i en verden, hvor at det kan være lidt svært at gennemskue, hvordan man ellers kan løse problemerne. Så er det med at bruge teknologien åbenbart nogle gange en lidt for let købt måde at gøre tingene på. Så det, vi gerne vil sætte ind over for, det er jo simpelthen den lovgivning, som bagved ligger omkring de her spørgsmål her, som rent faktisk tilsidesætter de borgerlige rettigheder, man ellers normalt har.
I er jo ikke alene, skal jeg huske at sige. I går i samarbejde med Forbrugerrådet Tænk, Amnesty International, IT Politisk Forening, Dansk Magisterforening og Bitbyrået. Og i tirsdags der afholdt I det første af en række arrangementer i Folketinget. Det vender vi tilbage til lidt om lidt her i programmet, der kalder sig for Aflytte, hvor vi også skal se på, om man kan fjernstyre en computer til at hacke sig ind på CSC. Vi skal kigge på fremtiden for privatliv på internettet i markedets hænder. Og til sidst skal vi en tur til en uddannelsesmesse med en vred NSA-agent, der ikke kan lide at blive fotograferet. Jeg hedder Anders Kjær Ulf. Velkommen til.
We're all right. There's no microphone here.
It takes a little while to realize you're not being overheard.
All watched. We can look at each other now and not be afraid.
We can say whatever we like to each other.
Du er stillet ind på Radio 24/7, programmet det hedder Aflyttet. Min gæst i dag, det er formanden for Forbundet af IT-professionelle, Niels Bertelsen. I tirsdags, der holdt du og nogle andre en tale i Folketingets fælles sal, og noget af det, som du talte varmt for, det var grundlovssikrede digitale rettigheder. Hvad kunne det være, en grundlovssikret digital rettighed?
Jamen, en grundlovssikret digital rettighed kunne være, at man fastsatte, at privatlivets fred også skulle gælde ude i cyberspace. Altså, den ukrænkelighed, der foregår på blandt andet brevområdet i det normale samfund, også gælder i det digitale samfund. Det vil sige, at man ikke bare kan tillade sig at affotografere eller kopiere korrespondance mellem to borgere, alene fordi det foregår elektronisk.
Du nævnte eksemplet, det var netop at sige, at det er ligesom almindelig post.
Jamen det er det jo i princippet, det er jo, at du afsender et brev elektronisk til en person, som du kender, og det betyder normalt, at det er hemmeligt, hvis du gjorde det via det kongeligt forordnede postvæsen, men når det er det elektroniske univers, så har de faktisk givet tilselskaberne påbud om, at de faktisk skal registrere både afsender og modtager.
Så det, der er sket, det er, at man laver noget ny teknologi, og så siger man, så er man kommet til at smide alle de her grundlæggende rettigheder ud, og lader som om de ikke længere eksisterer, og I vil så gerne gøre opmærksom på, at de er der altså stadig.
Ja, fuldstændig korrekt, fordi vi kan jo bare se, at det er skjult, det ligger skjult. Vorene ved det jo i virkeligheden ikke. De kan godt få det at vide, at det foregår, men man kan jo ikke rigtig se det, vel? Men hvis det står nede på postvæsenet, og de sidder der og kopierer dine breve, både forsiden og bagsiden, så vil man nok kunne lægge mærke til det, ikke? Men det foregår i det skjulte, og derfor er det meget nemmere at gøre det.
Jeg synes, at vi skal høre en stump fra en af de andre talere. Det er professor Søren Sandfeldt Jacobsen fra CBS, Center for Cybercrime og Security, der gav sit syn på de her love, som vi underlagt lige nu.
Min egen holdning er, at det er nok svært at undgå, at der finder overvågning sted. Vi lever trods alt i et informationssamfund. Det giver også en masse muligheder, også for en mere effektiv myndighedsvaretagelse. Der er nogle ting, der simpelthen bare bliver lettere, når vi kan bruge elektronisk kommunikation og også anvende data. Så at forestille sig, at vi skal til at skrue tid tilbage til før informationssamfundet, det er fuldstændig urealistisk, og det nytter ikke noget efter min opfattelse. Men reglerne kan, og det er egentlig mit væsentligste budskab her, reglerne kan bestemt godt gøres klarere. Og de vil i øvrigt have godt et eftersyn. Altså jeg vil synes, det var helt legitimt og meget, meget fordelagtigt, hvis Folketinget eller regeringen, måske dem begge to i fællesskab, i gang satte et eftersyn af alle de love, jeg nævnte før, for at se, om de kan stand the test i forhold til de kriterier, jeg nævner her. Er der tungvejende grunde nok til den her overvågning? Kunne et mindre indgribende mål, eller indgribende middel ind overvågning, eller den grad af overvågning, kunne det blive anvendt i stedet? Er brugeren overhovedet informeret? Og hvis brugeren er informeret, hvilken indflydelse har brugeren sig selv på det, hvis der bliver logget forkerte data, eller data, der ikke længere er relevante, osv.? Og så sikkerheden. Er sikkerheden omkring de her data? Og endelig, er der nogen, der fører kontrol med den, der overvåger? Og er det en effektiv kontrol? De her helt fundamentale spørgsmål, vil jeg som forsker sige, til det politiske system, sæt jer ned og gå lovende igennem og se, om de kan stande test. Og så lad os se, hvor vi står bagefter.
Det var professor Søren Sandfeldt Jacobsen fra CBS' Center for Cybercrime og Security, der talte ved Prosas konference på Christiansborg her i sidste uge. Niels Berthelsen, det her han jo blandt andet snakker om, det er faktisk også netop, at borgerne skal have indsigt i den måde, de bliver overvåget på. Hvordan kunne det måske lade sig gøre?
Jamen, det kunne foregå ved, at når man laver de her regler og forordninger, så gør man også opmærksom på, i forhold til borgerne, er det præcis det, vi gør, når du går ind her, så er det præcis det, vi registrerer. Og så kunne man måske jævnligt, det kan man jo godt gøre gennem, nu har man jo fået en digital post, sende dem måske en gang om året en opgørelse over, hvad vi rent faktisk registrerer på den enkelte borger. Altså, når man nu kan bruge teknologien til at overvåge borgerne, så kunne man også bruge dem til at give dem nogle rettigheder til også at følge med i, hvad der foregår.
Sådan ligesom, at vi har sundhed.dk, så skal vi også have sådan et, hvad hedder det, registreret.dk måske, eller sådan noget den stil, hvor man ligesom får en liste over, hvad der er blevet registreret om i løbet af et år.
Det kunne man sagtens forestille på borger.dk, at man på samme måde, som man registrerede dem hos lægen osv., så registrerede man altså også, når myndighederne på en eller anden måde fik adgang til nogle data om dig, eller bad om at få nogle data på borgeren.
Altså noget af det, som netop var en af formålene med den konference, jeg holdt, det er også at ligesom få fat i politikerne og gøre det, som Søren Sandfeldt Jacobsen snakker om, netop at bede dem om at kigge på de her love og se, om de holder til sådan nærmere vurdering. Hvordan synes du, det går med det blandt politikerne i dag?
Jamen, det går ikke særlig godt. Altså, man kan jo sige, at hele grundlaget for den måde, vi i dag overvåger på, nemlig gennem den efterhånden meget omtalte logningsbekendtgørelse, den blev bygget sådan, eller den opstod sådan, at man faktisk skulle evaluere den kort tid efter, at man havde introduceret den. Og den evaluering har man udskudt gang på gang på gang, og den er faktisk ikke foretaget endnu. Og nu står vi over for en situation, hvor at EU-domstolen har underkendt det bagvedliggende direktiv, til trods for, at vi ikke har evalueret den nu, så er man altså kommet frem til, at der stadig ikke er noget grundlag for at gøre noget ved den.
Og det interessante der, det er, at man har nærmest fået det til at fremstå, som om man har afskaffet den, fordi man har fjernet det, der hedder sessionslogning, men den er stadigvæk i effekt, eller den fungerer stadigvæk?
Jamen, den er fuldt ud kørende, og alle de andre oplysninger, som ikke er sessionslogning, bliver stadig registreret. Det skal tilsætskaberne stadigvæk gøre, når man går ind på nettet eller bruger sin mobiltelefon, så det stadig bliver registreret alle de oplysninger, som der også var der før. Så nej, der er ikke sket noget på den del af det.
De bliver stadig logget.
De bliver stadig logget, og det vil de fortsat gøre efter Justitsministeriets opfattelse. Den eneste grund til, at man fjernede sessionslogningen, var jo ikke, at man mente, at EU-domstolen havde ret, at man krænkede noget, eller det var ulovligt. Det var alene, fordi det var effektivt nok. Man fangede simpelthen ikke nok forbryder på den konto, så derfor har man afskaffet den del af det. Og det betyder jo så bare, at hvis der på en eller anden måde kan opstå en situation, hvor motoren igen kan blive mere effektiv, så ikke genintroducerer man garanteret den overvågning igen.
En anden taler ved jeres arrangement i Folketinget, det var aktivisten Peter Kofod, som gik videre end bare til snak. Han kom med opfordring til ulovligheder.
Så er der nogen af jer, der vil falde over dokumentation. Hemmelig dokumentation, som det aldrig havde været meningen, offentligheden skulle have set. Måske om masseovervågning. Måske om angrebskrig, eller folkeskolereform, eller salg af kampfly, eller køb af dong, eller et omvendt. Eller måske om dansk medvirken i droneangreb i lande, vi ikke er i krig med. Det er det, man normalt kalder mord. Eller måske om fortsat registrering af lovlig politisk virksomhed. Hint, hint. Måske er det noget, I kommer i kontakt med, fordi jeg arbejder som systemadministrator for en eller anden stor organisation, som ikke har helt reelt mel i posten, og der vil jeg gerne sende en varm tanke til mine venner i Forsvarets Efterretningstjeneste. Eller måske er det noget, I kommer i kontakt med, bare fordi I har nogle egenskaber med en computer, som gør, at hov, det ligger pludselig i skødet på jer. Når det sker, og det er faktisk sket for nogle af jer, tror jeg, så gå en lang tur og overvej, om I kan Leve med at vide, hvad I ved, uden at gøre noget. Fordi I kan gøre noget. I kan gøre det samme, som andre whistleblower har gjort. I kan give information om ting, der ikke burde foregå, tilbage til deres retmæssige ejere, offentligheden. Og det vil garanteret være ulovligt. Og I får sikkert røven på komedie. Og det er nemmere og billigere og en bedre forretning at lade være. Men det er også noget værd at kunne se sine børn i øjnene. Også om 10-15 år, når de siger, hvorfor fanden gjorde du ikke noget? Eller se sig selv i spejlet hver morgen. Hvad der er lovligt, er ikke altid det samme, som hvad der er rigtigt at gøre. I ved det selv, når I ser det. Og i de tilfælde, så vil jeg kraftigt opfordre jer alle sammen til ulovligheder. Og jeg kan ikke komme i tanke om et bedre sted at gøre det fra, end lige herinde på Christiansborg, lige nu i dag.
National Security Agency conducts worldwide surveillance. Fax, phones, satellite communication. The only ones in the country, including the military, could possibly have anything like this. Why are they after me? I don't know, and I don't want to know. Here they come.
Det var aktivist Peter Kofod, som opfordrer til whistleblowing, måske også lidt hackning, alt muligt andet forskelligt, og også selvom det skulle være ulovligt, det handler om, at det ligesom skal ske et eller andet. Niels Bertelsen fra Brugelser, tror du på den model?
Jeg tror på whistleblower-delen af den. Altså, hvis man bliver opmærksom på, at der foregår noget, som ikke burde foregå i forhold til systemer, man for eksempel sidder og administrerer eller er i gang med at udvikle, så skal man selvfølgelig råbe op om det og gøre opmærksom på det. Men at begå hackning og direkte ulovligheder, det vil jeg aldrig opfordre til.
Hvad kommer vi til at se fra jeres side fremover? Hvad har I mere i støbeskeen, om man så må sige?
Jamen, vi har jo ligesom lagt op til at snakke om grundlovssikrede rettigheder. Velviden er det med at ændre grundloven, det er ikke måde med bare at gøre på stående fod og med kort varsel. Så det er noget, der skal forberedes omhyggeligt. Men det vi snakker om, det er at lægge ned den ramme, der hedder nogle grundlæggende rettigheder. Og grundloven er god, fordi den er jo netop er de grundlæggende rettigheder for borgerne i samfundet. Så det vi gerne vil, det er at prøve at beskrive lidt mere præcist, hvad der er for nogle rettigheder, vi egentlig har i tankerne her. Altså i stedet for at diskutere alle de her sådan spredte fægtninger, vi har gjort gennem årene, nemlig omkring forbrugersikkerhed på nettet og kap og tapning af data på nettet og efterretningstjenestes adgang til at kigge på ens post osv., så prøv at sige, jamen, hvad er det nogle fundamentale rettigheder, mener, der skal være gældende? Det ene, det er dem, der i forvejen gælder, altså som jeg har sagt, brevhemmeligheden, boligens ukrænkelighed, de skal også gælde i den virtuelle verden. Men det kan også være, at der skal være nogle særlige rettigheder, der er gældende ved, at vi har en teknologisk udvikling, som gør, at det mere og mere bliver digitalt. Og det, vi skal prøve at kigge på nu. Så det, vi gør, det er, at vi har nu samlet en alliance af organisationer og mennesker, som mener det her alvorligt og gerne vil prøve at gøre noget ved det her, sådan, og så prøve at samle dem hen over efteråret til rent faktisk formulere noget, som politikerne tager med ind i Folketinget og diskuterer, om det ikke var den vej, vi skulle gå. Altså prøve med noget nationalt i første omgang, hvor vi kan være enige om, at det er det, vi gerne vil, når vi snakker om at udvikle vores digitale samfund, og så prøve at føre det ud i verden efterfølgende.
Det bliver spændende at følge. Du skal have rigtig mange tak til formand Niels Bertelsen fra Prosa. I forbindelse med internetdagen, en konference i København, der var der besøg fra London. Det var den kanadiske forfatter og aktivist Cory Doctorow, og ham kan du møde her.
One of the main problems about you science fiction writers is that everything you write has a tendency of coming true. And it's been so very dystopian the last couple of years.
See, I think that's backwards. I think what science fiction writers do is they look at things as they are and tell parables about them, as though they were taking place in the future, and then are afforded an unearned reputation for prescience. You know, almost everything that science fiction predicted didn't come true, but a very few small number of things had, which it would be remarkable if they hadn't. But science fiction writers or fans who praise the science fiction's predictive capacity is like someone who fires a shotgun into the side of a barn and then draws a target around the place where the pellets hit. You know, it's easy to get some right if you're willing to get a lot wrong.
Yeah, it was a punchy.
Science fiction forfattere, det er mennesker, der fyrer et haglgevær af ind i en stor lade, og så bagefter tegner en skive omkring de steder, hvor havlen ramte, siger forfatter og aktivist Cory Doctorow til mig, da jeg beklager mig over, at science fiction forfatteres fantasier har det med at blive til virkelighed senere, især de dystopiske af slagsen. Men sådan er det ikke, mener altså Cory Doctorow, der i 2008 skrev bogen Little Brother om fire teenagere i San Francisco, der bekæmper Homeland Securitys overgreb på den amerikanske forfatning. Senere skrev han Homeland, en slags forsættelse, der i øvrigt er blevet ramt af censur fra en større amerikansk skole, der mente, at den opfordrede til det, de kaldte mistro mod autoriteter, og som derfor fjernede den fra hylderne. Doktorovs reaktion var et langt brev til skolens ledelse og en donation på 200 bøger. Men lige nu sidder vi i en taxa i København på vej til internetdagen, hvor Cory Doctorow skal tale om privatliv på internettet og om den brudte tillid mellem brugerne og staten. Først så er der dog lige nogle mails, der skal hives ned.
Just I know what's in my mail. I just need to add myself a little reminder for tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Just go.
I pulled my mail with my phone when we landed. But we can start talking whenever you like, because okay. This is all pretty mechanical.
One of the things you hear in Denmark talking about is the current state of the internet.
Uh-huh.
And you are, one of the subjects is that the internet is it is broken and we need to restore trust uh-huh. currently. How do you see this coming along?
Well, I think that the post-Snowden era has actually been one of enormous hope. There was a lot of early commentary on Snowden from a certain kind of cynic who said, well, what did you expect? Didn't you think we were being spied on? And of course, you know, lots of people did worry that the internet was had the potential to be used for surveillance and that it was being used for surveillance. For example, in 2005, Mark Klein, who worked for AT&T, came into the offices of Electronic Frontier Foundation and said, when I was at AT&T, my job had been to build a secret room to run a fiber optic line into from which all the traffic going on AT&T's American backbones would be routed for the NSA. And this was, of course, totally illegal. And EFF had been suing for, you know, 7-8 years by the time Snowden came in out of the cold. And it had been on the front page of newspapers and so on. And so, yeah, there had been all this anxiety about it. But the problem had been, from EFF's perspective, twofold. The first was that the post-Bush American legal apparatus was structured so that secret laws had become very commonplace. So the legal framework under which AT&T was doing this interception was covered under a secret interpretation, a memo that had been written for the NSA by the Department of Justice that was itself considered a state secret. And so at every turn, when we tried to challenge this interpretation, the American legal apparatus stymied us because they said, well, you're not allowed to know what the law is, so you can't challenge the law. And so the post-Snowden era is one in which those interpretations have become public. And so those cases are moving forward. But the other thing was that there wasn't a lot of public concern about surveillance, not because the public doesn't worry about their privacy, but because understanding the cost to privacy of technology use is itself a highly technological matter, right? Understanding what happens to your Facebook posts and how that could present a risk to you is something that requires a fairly subtle amount of technological know-how. And as a consequence, we were trapped in a kind of vicious cycle where all the best tools for maintaining your privacy were exclusively designed for use by people who are already very technically sophisticated, because they were the only people who really cared about this stuff. And as a consequence, anyone who wasn't technically sophisticated, who decided to venture into the realm of privacy, quickly found themselves confused beyond all measure or reason and walked away from it, giving it up as a bad job. But after Snowden, just a year ago now, the Pew Internet Life Project, which is the leading pollster of American internet use, surveyed Americans' attitudes on privacy, and they found that in 3 short months since Snowden had come out, that 87% of Americans had tried to take some affirmative step to protect their privacy. Now, nothing they did mattered, right? Nothing they did any good at all, because there isn't a tick box in your Facebook dashboard that gives you privacy, right? There isn't a tick box in your browser configurator that gives you privacy, because none of them are designed to give you privacy, because nobody understood the privacy dimension except for technically sophisticated people who already understood that you couldn't get privacy from Facebook. So now 87% of Americans wanting a tool, a product that no one is selling, is not a problem, it's an opportunity.
Tiden efter Edward Snowden er en periode fyldt med håb, mener Cory Doctorow. Der var ganske vist masser af skeptikere, der bare sagde, troede du virkelig ikke, du blev overvåget, og folk havde generelt været bekymrede, også før Snowden. Hovedproblemet er, at i tiden efter præsident Bush, den første af dem altså, der opstod der bunker af hemmelige love, som man ikke kunne få indsigt i. Med Snowdens afsløringer fandt vi ud af, hvad der skete i lovgivernes maskinrum, og nu kan organisationer som Electronic Frontier Foundation udfordre de regler. Og så er almindelige mennesker begyndt at interessere sig for, hvad der for eksempel foregår med de data, de afleverer på sociale netværk som Facebook eller andre steder. 3 måneder efter Snowdens afsløring havde ramt USA, ja, der havde 87% af befolkningen ifølge en undersøgelse forsøgt at forbedre deres privatliv på internettet.
And I think that, you know, there's the reason that Silicon Valley backed the surveillance business model is not because of an ideological commitment to surveillance, it's because of an ideological commitment to profit. And when there was profit in surveillance, they made surveillance technology. They are mercenaries. They'll make profits selling anti-surveillance technology just as readily as pro-surveillance technology, and there's no ideological reason to do one over the other apart from the likely return. And in the side of the ideology where you have non-profit sector who are ideologically committed to giving people privacy and freedom, that dovetails very nicely. And so I'm actually quite hopeful. And then I'm also on the advisory committee of a for-profit entity called Wickr that's one of many secure alternatives to Snapchat, where it's a mobile app you can install on your device, and you can send and receive messages and files and images with it. And unless you take some extraordinary measure, they're automatically and very securely deleted, so that I may trust you. In fact, I do trust you to receive my messages and to keep them secret, but I don't trust you not to lose your phone or not to have it taken away at a border and searched or not to have it hacked remotely. And so what this does is this gives us a mechanical system by which our own human frailty, not our untrustworthiness, but our lack of discipline in really rigorously making sure we delete everything that we should delete when we're done with it, where that is something that machines handle. Because, of course, that's what we want machines to do. All those things that require machine-like diligence should be handled by machines, because that's what they're good at, and it frees humans up to do human things.
Når opfinderne i Silicon Valley baggede NSA's overvågningsindustri, ja, så var det fordi, der var penge i det. De firmaer er lejesoldater, og de går efter det, der giver penge her og nu. Og fremover, så er der altså penge i software, der kan give almindelige mennesker deres privatliv tilbage, siger Dr. Roth. Der blandt andet ser gode takter hos chatprogrammet Vicom. Et alternativ til Snapchat, der bruger end-to-end kryptering. Og så er han glad for, at Google nu endelig vil kryptere deres Gmail-konti. Ikke fordi han bruger Gmail. Han har gennem mange år haft sin egen yderst velbevogte mailserver, men fordi alle dem, han sender mails til, gør. Og så ligger hans mails jo også der hos Google. Men hvad med den statsstyrede masseovervågning? Som det ser ud nu, bliver borgerne mere og mere gennemsigtige, mens staterne lukker sig om sig selv. Hvordan vil Doktorov ændre det?
So I think that that's a very important point. The rallying cry of transparency for the powerful and privacy for the powerless is a very important principle on which to base governance, right? That you need security from overarching surveillance when you don't have power in the state. The more power you have, the less that privacy becomes important. This is why you often have people like me who are middle class and white and hetero and don't have a lot of secrets in their closet saying, oh, what do I need privacy for? And of course, these people are blind to the fact that their unearned privilege means that they have fewer skeletons in their closet. And it's not through it's not through some moral failing that other people have things that they don't necessarily want revealed. It's in fact our great and good unearned fortune that allows us to do this. And I always feel like if you are lucky enough not to have any skeletons in your closet, well, you certainly owe it to your brothers and sisters and parents and cousins and friends who have not got your unearned privilege to provide them with cover and to see to it that the only people using privacy tools are not those people who are already vulnerable. And the amazing news for us who care about these wider justice questions is that because cryptography works, we have the power to build secure communications infrastructure that allow people to collaborate with one another without being spied upon or having their communications interdicted or altered by more powerful actors. And this is a new thing in the world. We've never had this power before. And communications themselves have been the key to all social movements. There's a reason Trotsky's first act after the October Revolution was to seize the post and telephone office, because that's the beating heart of the nation state, right? It's communications infrastructure. Well, We now have the power, using a computer that you have in your pocket, to scramble a message so thoroughly that if every hydrogen atom in the universe were turned into a computer that did nothing from now until the end of time but try to break that message, it would never succeed. That's a new thing on the Earth, right? And Edward Snowden, who's the only person who's in a position to know who's talking, says that the one thing that the intelligence apparatus can't do is frontally assault the cryptography. They can try and get people to induce errors into the programs. They can try and subvert the company so they deliberately put backdoors in them. They can try and subvert the standard setting process. But the maths themselves are solid and they work. And so the good news is we can build networks of integrity. We can build the freedom layer into our tools. That freedom layer not only protects us from crooks and voyeurs and so on, it also protects us from states and spies and other bad actors. And we can use that to hold the powerful to account.
Vi skal have privatliv for dem uden magt og total gennemsigtighed til dem, der har magten, mener Dr. Orff. Generelt er verden blevet mere og mere korrupt de sidste 20 år, mener han. Vi har fået megafirmaer, og pengene bliver koncentreret ganske få steder. Og vi er nødt til at få reguleret de multinationale og få styr på det her, ellers går det galt, siger han, og nævner et kinesisk firma, der har indgået hemmelige aftaler om olie med Canadas regering. Det vigtigste, vi kan gøre, det er at samarbejde på tværs af grænser, og det kan kun gøres ved at have fri og fair og åbne informationsstrukturer. Og det, der hjælper os med det lige nu, det er kryptering. Kryptering, det virker, og det giver os helt nye muligheder. Det er første gang, folket har kraft til at kommunikere så hemmeligt, at ingen nogensinde kan bryde ind. Vi kan bygge et frihedslag ind i vores værktøjer, og det skal vi bruge til at holde de med magt ansvarlige, siger Cory Doctorow. Imens er taxaen til internetdagen næsten kommet frem, og jeg har ganske kort tid til at spørge ham om et lidt andet emne, nemlig singularitetsteoretikerne. Singularitetsteoretikere er meget glade for big data og sikre på, at alle verdens problemer vil blive løst af computere med kunstig intelligens, der alle sammen arbejder frem imod, at det hele samles i et punkt i en singularitet, der skal bare være data nok. Men hvad synes Cory Doctorow om den bevægelse, der blandt andet tæller flere ledende skikkelser i Google, bunker, ingeniører og mediefolk, også her i Danmark, der blandt andet går på et særligt universitet, Singularity University, for at lære mere om de gyldne datatider, der venter? Doctorows svar sender os tilbage til begyndelsen, der hvor vi talte om science fiction.
Just thinking about something else, which is a bit off topic here, but it also plays into it. I'm currently very, I'm a bit worried about all these singularity people that are going on. What are your opinion on singularity?
So, you know, I've written lots of books in which the singularity is a literary device. I think the singularity is a best understood as one of science fiction's signature and most important moves, which is to predict the present. That what the singularity tells you is not where we're headed, but how we think about the technology that we're living in now. And there are lots of dimensions to that. The most significant one is that the key to the singularity is that technology will eventually become so powerful that no one can make sense of it. And a lot of the people who advance the theory of singularity are people who were once very technologically au fait, but are now finding themselves lagging. And I think that you see in that anxiety that technology will outstrip our ability to understand it a personal reflection of the anxiety of people who were once masters of technology and now can't keep track of how to configure their Wi-Fi router. So I think that it is best understood as a parable and not as a prediction.
Thank you.
It's Chancellor Sutler.
Guys, I see him.
And the truth is, there is something terribly wrong with this country, isn't there?
Cory Doctorows bøger kan i øvrigt frit downloades i elektronisk format under Creative Commons Copyright. Vi lægger et par links på vores Facebook-side. I sidste uge der gik hackersagen i Frederiksberg ret ind i en ny fase, hvor blandt andet den 21-årige anklagede dansker for første gang udtalte sig om det indbrud, der angiveligt har været i Computer Science Corporations server. Et indbrud, der har kompromitteret blandt andet kørekortsregistret, kriminalregistret og CPR-registret, der alle er placeret hos den amerikanske computergigants åbenbart sårbare server. Den anden anklagede, det er svenskeren Gottfried Svartholm Vark, kaldet Anacata. Og sidste fredag, der kommer amerikaneren Jacob Applebaum til Danmark for at vidne til hans fordel. Applebaum er sikkerhedsekspert, Tor-programmør og talsmand for Tor-netværket. Applebaum havde den umiddelbart sære opgave at bevise, at Anacatas computer kunne fjernstyres. Og på forhånd, der havde anklager Anders Riesager forsøgt at fjerne Applebaum som vidne, da han mente, han var partisk. Dirk Applebaum havde til gengæld sin egen mening om anklageren. Hør bare her.
It's clear that he not only does not understand detailed technical things, it's pretty obvious he does not understand anything related to technology at all.
Sådan sagde amerikaneren, da han stod omringet af journalister efter sin vidneforklaring. Applebaum mener altså ikke, at anklageren forstår substansen i den sag, han fører. Applebaum er indkaldt som vidne af advokat Louise Høj, der repræsenterer den svenske tiltalte og Pirate Bay-grundlægger Gottfried Svartholm Vark. I september i 2012 sparker kambodiansk politi døren ind til Varks lejlighed i Phnom Penh og anholder ham i forbindelse med et hackerangreb på den svenske virksomhed Logica og banken Nordea. Han bliver udleveret til retsforfølgelse i Sverige. På en krypteret del af hans computer finder svensk politi filer, der stammer fra et hackerangreb mod CSC i Danmark. CSC ligger blandt andet serverplads til Rigspolitiets databaser, og ingen hos CSC havde opdaget hackerangrebet, der havde stået på i 5 måneder, da Vark bliver anholdt i Kambodja. Efter hans anholdelse stopper angrebet. En 21-årig dansk mand er også tiltalt i sagen. Politiet mener, at han forsøgte at hjælpe Vark med at finde en vej ind i CSC's computer ved hjælp af brugernavne og passwords, der tilhører danske politibetjente. Den danske tiltalte er omfattet af et navneforbud. Vark blev idømt 1 års fængsel for indbrud i Logicas systemer, men blev frikendt for indbrud hos Nordea. Den svenske domstol kunne ikke afvise, at hans computer var blevet fjernstyret af andre, der havde brugt den til at bryde ind hos Nordea. Vark bestrider ikke, at hans computer blev brugt til angrebet, men ligesom i sagen om Nordea, hævder han, at computeren blev fjernstyret af andre i forbindelse med hackerangrebet mod CSC. En af de pointer, som Jacob Applebaum kommer med i retten, er, at det sagtens kan lade sig gøre, og at sikkerheden på Varks computer er meget lav. Det er helt bevidst, fordi computeren er en såkaldt lab-computer, der er sat sådan op, at flere brugere har fjernadgang til den, og på den måde kan samarbejde om projekter på maskinen.
It's a lab computer, and it's clearly a lab computer, and there are multiple people who are allowed to use it. So I would expect it to have a lower security than, say, a secured communication system of some kind. He's obviously not trying to do that, but if it's a shared computer, of course, that is what you would expect. But I wasn't surprised by this because it's the same facts that were misrepresented in Sweden that are being, I think, misrepresented here in Denmark. And I don't think it's intentional. I just think that the prosecutor is ignorant of the topic. And he has said that himself. And that is an important detail. It's everyone has justice in mind, but he clearly does not have technical details in mind.
Applebaum mener, at det er fuldstændig troværdigt, at Vark's computer blev fjernstyret. Logfilerne på computeren viser, at den er fuldstændig inficeret med vira og bagdøre, eller som han selv udtrykker det, maskinen er et ildelugtende lortehul og en total joke, hvad angår sikkerhed.
I think that there's absolutely a possibility, but even more so, there seems to be a certainty in the sense that there are a bunch of other accounts on the system which are not him. Presumably, they're not his. Therefore, combined with the fact that someone can use it, you know, they talked about the squalid conditions of his house, and they showed a video, I think, of him looking like a, you know, decrepit junkie or something like that. His computer was the equivalent of that, right? His computer was without a doubt, like, it was a rancid shithole of security bugs and backdoors and everything. It was just a completely ridiculous situation. And that computer, like I said, if they plugged it into the network here at the court, someone would come running to unplug it. So in my professional opinion, that is without a doubt a possibility. And if you look at the error logs, which they didn't bring up in court today, which I was surprised about, they specifically say there's this many events, this many reboots. They meant restarts of the firewall and restarts of the computer, this many sleep events. And then they said there were 41 other events and crashes. This is a very important detail. What they're saying is the computer was misbehaving, and we have logged evidence of that misbehavior. That's exculpatory evidence right there that shows that this is a piece of crap computer used by lots of people. It's a total security joke, and it's malfunctioning. If someone were to try to break into it, like to exploit the web browser or something, as I put forth in the case, it's pretty obvious that those log files would be worth looking into. If you saw Adobe Flash Player crashing, for example, you're probably going to find proof that someone exploited the web browser, or at least Adobe Flash is part of the web browser.
Gerningscomputeren opfører sig altså mærkeligt. Den er fyldt med fejl og går ofte ned. Det er bevismateriale, som burde tale for, at der er ugler i mosen, og måske endda ondsindede hackere med fjernadgang til maskinen, siger Applebaum. Men hvorfor har en meget IT-kyndig person som Varg en computer, der står pivåben for alskens angreb?
Well, that's really easy. Microsoft, thankfully, has helped us all with this problem a lot. You know that if your computer is infected with a virus and does something, that it's not you that did it. This is kind of a philosophical point, but your computer is not you, and Gottfried's computer is not him. Gottfried's computer was shared by many people physically in one room where many people had access, and remotely it appears that that was also true. In fact, it even connected to another computer which is not being presented in court, which again, exculpatory evidence is being denied to the defense team. That to me makes actually quite a lot of sense. That's not his secure computer. That's a computer that is not secured, and he cannot be responsible for that unless we are to say that we are our devices. We aren't our devices. You have an iPhone here, you have an iPhone there. If somebody breaks into that, like the PET, who is allowed to break into it, and then they do something to someone else, should we really create a society that says that because you were negligent enough to carry a phone, you should be responsible for everything the phone does? That makes no sense. We don't have that. So it makes sense to me to consider that Gottfried didn't try to secure this computer because it wasn't meant to be secured. In fact, he meant to share it with other people. And that means that there's a group of people. Their names have come up. Their nicknames have come up in the trial. And he's being punished probably for one of them. Right? They say there's no honor among thieves. Well, there's no honor amongst a hacker collective of people or a hacker group of people like this where two of them are in trouble and five of them are not. I mean, I don't know all the details of that group, but it seems quite clear that if those other people had access to his computer, then they can do whatever they want, and Gottfried will go to jail for it. In fact, he's already been in jail. And the other gentleman has been in jail for over a year. I mean, as I understand it, he doesn't even have a name in the press. So that strikes me as a crazy situation.
Vores samfund er ikke indrettet sådan, at vi skal stå på mål for alt, hvad vores dimser foretager sig, hvis de styrer sig andre. Og sådan skal det heller ikke være, siger Applebaum. Du er ikke din computer, og det samme gælder for en dygtig hacker som Varg. Ej heller, selvom han har lavet døren til maskinen stå åben og nøglerne sidde i. Applebaum mener ikke, at det er alt bevismaterialet fra gerningscomputeren, der bliver taget i betragtning, når politiets teknikere peger på Varg som manden bag indbruddet. Heller ikke bevismaterialet fra de systemer, hvor indbruddet skete, bliver behandlet korrekt, hvis man spørger Applebaum. Han er utilfreds med, at politiets efterforskere ikke selv har haft adgang til CSC-systemer for at sikre beviser. I stedet har CSC udleveret, hvad politiet har bedt om.
Well, I think it's very clear from an article that was released late last night, early this morning, that the evidence being collected by the victim is tainted evidence. That doesn't meet the standard of justice that anyone would have expected anywhere. Imagine that I said there was a murder, and I said, and by the way, here's some bloody thing. That's the evidence. Well, that's a tainted, inadmissible piece of evidence, probably. Obviously, that's for the judge and for the jury to decide, but it seems to me quite clear that that has occurred with CSC. So there is something to be said about how you could put a computer on the internet that is vulnerable in this way and that someone could break into it. That amounts to, in my mind, negligence. And then to do these forensics processes without giving the evidence to the state means that they can selectively manipulate what evidence is available, which we see systematic across the whole case. For example, Gottfried's defense lawyer does not have access to a copy of the hard drive. That means exculpatory evidence, which is a necessity for due process and for justice, is missing. And in the Sapo case in Sweden, where they made this file, they specifically said, we have ruled out the computer could be remote controlled. But later in court, they withdrew that because they admitted in court that they had not actually even examined the whole computer. And again, this is, I believe, clear malice or ignorance, or a little bit of both, depending on how you see these things.
Det er problematisk, og ikke i overensstemmelse med en retfærdig rettergang, hvis offeret i en forbrydelse får lov at holde bevismaterialet for sig selv, siger Applebaum. Problemet med politiets manglende adgang til CSC's computersystemer, eller gerningsstedet, om man vil, er, at CSC får muligheden for at udvælge nogle beviser og fravælge andre. Stod det til Applebaum, skulle der sikres og præsenteres mange flere beviser i sagen.
Well, for one, I would take, I would acquire a memory image of the computer. I would look at every file on the computer. I would give full access to the information to the defense so that they can actually look for exculpatory information, which is usually required by a fair trial. I would also have talked about the desktop computer, the router at the house. I would talk about more of these details, and they're not. And furthermore, for the CSC server side, I would ask for very specific information. What was the exploit that was used? Where was the payload? What's the network traces? Are there network traces? You know, where were his whereabouts and so on? Like all of these things and a forensic image of that server. And if there isn't one, if there isn't a memory capture from that, if there isn't a disk capture from that, that's also presented to the defense team. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's not forensically sound. And when the computer goes from Gottfried's hands to the Cambodian police who held him incommunicado, you know, the anti-terror people took him and held him. People with machine guns went and got this, like, as the prosecutor said, poor sickly Swedish guy living in squalor. Then they took him. Then somehow he ended up in Sweden, again in incommunicado. And then at some point that laptop went to the Swedes, and now the Swedes will not give it to the Danes. How can the Danes do that? How can they accept that as evidence? That's not a forensically sound chain of evidence. The chain of custody is broken, and they don't even have the evidence. They only have screenshots of the evidence and a few small extracts. It's tragic.
Den måde bevismaterialet bliver håndteret på, hvorfor folk til at bryde ud i latter. Ikke fordi det er komisk, men fordi det er tragisk. Man burde have taget et øjebliksbillede af gerningscomputerens hukommelse, og det samme for CSC's servere. Samtidig burde de svenske myndigheder, som anholdt VARK, udlevere det konfiskerede hardware, i stedet for kun at sende dansk politi screenshots af indholdet på VARKs computer. Teknologisk uvidenhed er dog ikke den eneste grund til, at VARK sidder på anklagebænken. Der er også tale om politisk forfølgelse. Det er samme politiske forfølgelse, som Jacob Applebaum selv mener at være udsat for af den amerikanske regering på grund af sit samarbejde med Wikileaks. Den svenske og den danske regering har simpelthen set sig sure på VARK og hans venner fra Pirate Bay.
There are several things, but one of the things that is quite clear is that if we look to definitions of political prisoners and prisoners of conscience, we see that anyone who is jailed and put in incommunicado, those people, when they're no longer allowed to speak their beliefs, when they're no longer allowed to communicate, that is one of the fundamental and core components of being a political prisoner. So, for example, when Cambodia arrested him and detained him, and they did not allow him to speak to anyone, the embassy could not reach him, his family couldn't reach him, and no one knew where he was, and then suddenly he was in Sweden. And again, he was held incommunicado for long periods of time, held in solitary confinement, denied access to all sorts of systems, and treated as if he were a violent criminal. And it is clear that since he has never advocated the use of violence, he probably qualifies as a prisoner of conscience. But because he's white and this is Scandinavia, people laugh at that.
Folk griner af tanken om politiske fanger i Skandinavien, men det er ikke desto mindre, hvad Applebaum mener er tilfældet for VARK. Sagens politiske karakter er også årsagen til, at anklageren forsøgte at forhindre Applebaum i at vidne i sagen. Stod det til amerikaneren, så skulle anklageren kaste nettet ud efter større fisk end dem, der brød ind hos CSC.
Why is this prosecutor, with no evidence at all, going after these two gentlemen in court, instead of dealing with, for example, the Rampart A scandal, where it is very clear that the NSA is wiretapping the fiber connections, wiretapping everybody in this entire country, in fact, probably with the PET. Why is it that they're not investigating that? That's a crime a millisecond, and you know who's committing it, and it's in public. And the answer is because it is political, because the intelligence agencies are beyond reproach, and Gottfried Svartholm is a foreign Swede who does not matter to anyone, in their view. I don't know if he'll have a fair trial, but here's my prediction. No matter what the outcome, Gottfried Svartholm Vlog will not walk free from Denmark. I think what will happen is that he will be extradited to another country. Because my understanding is that the hard drive in Sweden was not sent to Denmark because it contains, quote, information about a third country. So what that means is that they're withholding exculpatory evidence about him, and they will not even give the full evidence to the Danish police, except in the form of screenshots and printouts, which, by the way, what is that? And then when they're done with him here, they're going to send him onward.
Det var Oliver Berntsen, der havde talt med Jacob Applebaum. CSC-hackersagen den fortsætter i den kommende uge. NSA's overvågning af blandt andet Danmark, det bliver stadigvæk ikke behandlet overhovedet. Det gør det til gengæld i New Zealand, der i den her uge har holdt en stor konference kaldet Moment of Truth, sandhedens øjeblik. Konferencen den var arrangeret af Kim.com, der tidligere har været på anklagebænken i USA for copyright-krænkelser via sit site Mega Upload, men nu er på fri fod igen, og blandt andet havde inviteret journalist Glenn Greenwald og så to mand via videolink til sin konference om masseovervågning i New Zealand. Den ene af de her mennesker på videolink, det var WikiLeaks' Julian Assange, den anden, det var Edward Snowden, der her giver en forklaring på, hvordan masseovervågning fra NSA virker.
Thank you. I think what's happening is a careful parsing of words. He's saying this isn't mass surveillance, even though, you know, GCSB is collecting all of your information. They're sharing it with NSA. NSA is doing it and then providing that same information to us so we don't have to do it domestically. We don't have to collect it domestically. We just get to search their copies of our citizens' data. He's saying it's not surveillance because as long as, you know, in these trillions of records that are collected, not every single record is read by a human being when they come in the morning like it's email. But even that is not entirely true, and it's inaccurate in many ways. So when I worked at the NSA, my last position was as an infrastructure analyst. You can think of it as sort of a state-sponsored hacker, where what you do is you look at network infrastructure, you look at routers, you look at all the connection points, you look at companies, and you look at targets around the world, and you figure out how their networks work, how they fit together, and how to break into them. You're basically sort of a burglar casing the joint. That was when I realized the absolute scale of how deep this went. Because when I was doing this, I would see the communications of individuals from around the world. I could be looking at a system in Japan. I could be looking at a system in Germany. I could be looking at a system in New Zealand. And what was incredible was the fact that I could see records of the communications of people around the world from every country comprehensively. The way it works is X key score is what you can think of as a sort of a, in technical terms, a federated search system. What it means is the NSA, along with the Five Eyes sort of alliance, which includes New Zealand as a significant part of it, to put a system of sensors around the world. You can think of these as tapping devices. Some of them are cable taps. Some of them are well, what's been reported are cable taps so far, so let's leave it there. But the key is you've got this network of sensors around the world, and then I, sitting at the NSA in Hawaii, come in the morning, I type in my search. I look for, let's say I want to read John Key's email. I enter his email address, and it sends that search to every one of these sensor networks around the world. And they search their local database of metadata and content. The content of all communications that pass through these sites is held for about 3 to 5 days, depending on the storage. And it's constantly getting constantly going back further and further in time as we gain more capability. So I can see everything. I can see what book you looked at Amazon.com, you know, last week. I can see who you talked to. I can see who your friends on Facebook are. I can see the text messages you sent. I can read the emails you wrote. And I can set up things that are called fingerprints that allow me to track where you've been on the web, who you're talking to, even if you're using sort of anonymizing technology and so forth. Now, what's interesting about these sensor networks is when I'm typing in this search for an email address, I say where in the world, which of these sensors I want it to go to. And I know that there's mass surveillance happening in New Zealand because one of those checkboxes, one of those sensor networks, is in New Zealand. So when John Key or anyone in the New Zealand government says there is no mass surveillance in New Zealand, and they wave cyber protection programs around or whatever they want to call it, they talk about Project Cortex, they're distracting from the main question. When a journalist hears, you know, oh, there's no mass surveillance in surveillance or in New Zealand, they need to follow up, they need to press, and they need to say, Mr. Prime Minister, what about X key score? What about the GCSB's involvement in X Key Score? What about New Zealand's involvement in the X Key Score mass surveillance program? And to this day, he said, I won't talk about this. I won't talk about this because it's related to foreign intelligence. But is it related to foreign intelligence if it's collecting the communications of every man, woman, and child in the country of New Zealand?
Det var altså Edward Snowden fra Moment of Truth, der fortalte om, hvordan New Zealand masseovervåger deres borgere via NSA og søgeprogrammet X-Key Score. Noget, der naturligvis bliver benægtet hårdnakket af New Zealands premierminister. Hvorvidt det samme det sker i Danmark? Ja, vores politikere de siger jo, at der ikke har nogen grund til at tro, at der finder noget ulovligt sted, og det kan man så tænke sit omkring.
It may just be my imagination. Whatever it is that's watching, it's not human.
Her til sidst i audio, der skal vi lige en tur forbi University of New Mexico, hvor der torsdag var karrieredag for unge ingeniører og andre videnskabsmænd. En af standene, den var bemandet af en mand, der kaldte sig for Neil Sett. Han var fra NSA, og han håbede på at kunne rekruttere nogle unge videnskabsmænd til at arbejde for dem. Men så kom to unge mænd med et kamera forbi og begyndte at stille ham spørgsmål. Det første, det handlede om, hvorvidt NSA måtte kunne hjælpe dem med at finde en forsvunden mor.
Excuse me, sir. I've got a quick question that your colleague here wasn't able to help me out with. I'm trying to locate my mom. She's been traveling cross-country for a couple of weeks, and I haven't heard from her. Do you guys know where she is?
No. NSA is not permitted to track or collect intelligence about U.S. persons.
And yet you do. You track and collect...
Absolutely. Do not.
You absolutely do. You collect all the metadata on all U.S. phone calls.
Actually, we do not collect it.
You collect
and store. If you look carefully at the law, you'll see that we get that data under law, right? We have the legal authority through the FISA court to collect certain data that aids foreign intelligence.
So why is it legal to collect information on every American citizen?
You do not understand what that collection is about. And if you don't leave soon, I'm going to call the university security to get you out of my face. I am here to recruit, not to argue
right.
legal basis with someone who's uninformed about the law.
And I would argue that legally and morally, you have absolutely
okay,
no
done.
Right to recruit.
And you're done. I'm not grabbing my
Do
phone.
Not.
I'm not touching your phone.
You just did it. Get off.
You just touched my phone.
Yankee, Hotel, Foxtrot.
Man kan læse hele historien om, hvad der siden skete med de spørgeløsne unge mænd og med NSA's Neil Sett på websitet The Intercept. Aflyttet er forbi for i dag. Producer det var Oliver Berensen. Teknikken stod Nikolaj Kirk for, og jeg hedder Anders Kjær Ulf. Vi vender naturligvis tilbage i næste uge med mere nyt fra Det Knuste Spejl, hvis skår vi ruller os i. I sæk og aske ruller vi os. Presser frydefuldt og blødende, vær splint ind under huden og smiler ekstatisk til kamera i nye iPhones, mens vi venter på, de finder vej til hjertet og vil gøre, og vil vende alting på hovedet, og vi igen kan drømme om sandheden i én sjæl og ét legeme, men det bliver ikke lige nu, og det bliver måske heller ikke om lidt.
Call connected to the NSA. Complete transmission to the NSA. Suspending your rights for the duration of the permanent war.
Rapporterne.
Fra et andet times tid, så begyndte vi et lille socialt eksperiment. Vi satte Asger ud på Nørrebro i København med Charlotte.
Jamen, jeg generer ikke nogen. Okay, jeg vil meget gerne snakke. Hvis du har lyst til at snakke, så skal du være velkommen. Nå, er det på grund af Charlotte? Ej, lad være. Må jeg ikke få den igen? Ja, nu har de taget Charlotten af, det er faktisk et problem. Jeg smutter.
Med Asger Juhl, Anders Olling og Jens Anton Klinken.
Det var vildt ubehageligt. De står rundt om mig, ikke?
Og det er så de samme, som var nede ved kaffebaren,
det er dem,
der
som
så
kørte også...
efter. Og så er der nogen, der stiger ud af en bil.
Det er jo,
kan I gå videre? Så kan jeg lige gå op på taget og ryge en cigaret. Det tror jeg, det er brug for, nemlig. Man skal heller ikke sidde og hygge sig i kakkelovnskrogen, når man er journalist. Når man pisser, så pisser man imod ved det.
Rapporterne. Alle hverdage fra 15 til 18. Her på Radio 24/7.
Der er et stort opbrud i gang. De sociale frustrationer, man ser efter krisen mod det politiske establishment, fører til, at folk stemmer på nationalistpartierne her i Danmark, Dansk Folkeparti.
Det Røde Felt. Et debatprogram,
med klar slagside til venstre.
Vi er i den absurde situation, at der nu for første gang er egentlig erklærede nazister, der kommer ind i Europaparlamentet.
Start ugen helt op i det røde felt med Lars Trier Mogensen.
På mig virker det som om, at de sådan politiske konjunkturer, pendulsvingninger, er kommet helt ud af kontrol.
Det røde felt. Hver mandag kl. 10. Her på Radio 24/7.
Du lytter til Radio 24/7. Om lidt er der nyheder.